Good morning and welcome to Highway 101. My guest today has been a journalist for almost 40 years and one of America's most celebrated investigative correspondents for much of that time. He was one of the originators of ABC's current affairs magazine programme 2020. He left that to work on 60 Minutes with CBS. He's won countless awards, including the Pulitzer Prize, and has watched himself played by Al Pacino on screen in the Michael Mann film The Insider, which dealt with the revelations of Dr. Jeffrey Wigand against his employers, the tobacco manufacturers Brown and Williamson, and, of course, the ructions that followed in CBS when the company pulled Wigand's on-camera interview in a move which the New York Times described as dishonouring the legacy of Edward R. Murrow. Lowell Bergman, you're very welcome.
Nice to be here.
Now, you grew up in New York. Did you grow up in comfortable circumstances or straitened circumstances, shall we say?
A variety of circumstances. I'd say more straitened at the mid part in the early 1950s and got better in the 60s. And then I managed to flee New York in 1963.
I think your father was not much of a presence after about, what, I think it was about 9 or 10 years, the first 9 or 10 years of your life.
He left for Europe in 1952. So I was about 7 years old.
What effect did that have on you?
Well, it had a dramatic economic effect. And so I know what it's like to grow up in a single family household. My parents divorced about that time as well, and held a job actually starting at the age of 10.
What kind of a job?
Newspaper deliveries. We used to my older brother and I used to take in all the laundry in the neighborhood and iron the sheets and pillowcases we managed with. You know, those days they had what was called S&H green stamps, you know, which you got at the grocery store. And my mother gave those to us, and we got a large sort of industrial iron with it, and we could iron all of the local underwear and sheets.
So Lowell Bergman did laundry at some stage.
Lowell Bergman's done laundry. Lowell Bergman's delivered newspapers. Lowell Bergman's worked in boat yards, and I became an apprentice typographer about 1961.
So typography and delivering newspapers, I suppose that must have had some kind of lasting effect.
No, the newspaper part, the best part was that if you sold enough subscriptions, you can get a free baseball glove.
The FBI apparently showed an interest in both of your parents at different times for different reasons, didn't they?
The FBI had interest in my mother and my aunt because back in the 30s and early 40s, they had been involved in organizations which I would assume they called communist fronts or something of that nature. It was when the U.S. and the Soviet Union were more closely allied. And my father was in the fur and leather business in New York when he was in the United States and had some interactions with people who he always had remembered fondly afterwards when I would talk with him. But I think who the IRS, which then had a very active criminal
revenue
investigation.
Service.
Yeah. And these were people who were in the Italian mafia, and he was related to them in the fur business.
And your grandparents were labor activists.
My grandmother was a founder of the Embroiderers Workers Local in New York City in about 1912. It was the first secretary and treasurer of the local, and I've got some beautiful photographs of her from that period where she's surrounded by 21 men, one of the board members later became my grandfather.
So were you, if you like, taking in left-wing politics from a very, very early age?
I wasn't getting very much doctrine. I was getting more or less sympathy with Franklin Roosevelt or my grandmother could remember Emma Goldman, the anarchist, giving speeches at Union Square in New York and explaining to me that she could actually speak to 10 or 15,000 people without any amplification.
Small little woman.
A small little woman, apparently, with a big mouth.
So, I mean, you were from them, I suppose you were at least getting a sense of history, were you? A sense of history and politics.
I got a sense of history and politics and the idea that it would be better to grow up and get a job where you didn't have to punch a clock.
Now, you did philosophy in college and you studied under the radical philosopher Herbert Marcuse. Tell me a little bit about him. Interesting man.
Well, actually, to back up, I studied with a number of German emigre teachers, first at the University of Wisconsin, Hans Gerth, who was the guy who translated Max Weber into English, and a George Mossy, who passed away recently, who was the first real cultural historian of the rise of Nazism in Germany and anti-Semitism. And they both thought that I should go study with Marcuse, who was in San Diego at the time, the University of California in San Diego. And he represented, I was actually studying sort of the history of philosophy. He represented the attempt to develop what we'd call, let's say, a humanist socialist perspective or Marxist perspective on the world. And he tried to meld together everything from Freud to Marx to Hegel and so on. I refer to it now as my time studying Hegel, Bagel, and Schlegel.
And you also worked fairly early on for Ramparts magazine. It was a small left-wing publication that grew and grew in the 1960s. What sort of work were you doing for Ramparts?
Well, actually, the first story I did for Ramparts, which grew out of the work that we did in San Diego, was a guide in those days. We called it Uncovering Undercover Agents. And really, it was a public record guide because we had the experience in San Diego of being the targets of various law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, and sort of some very amateurish attempts by the local police to infiltrate the newspaper, and so or get it close to us. And so what we had instituted was just a simple application form. You know, if you wanted to sell the newspaper, if you wanted to work on the newspaper, you just filled out this simple application form that said where you were born, what's your mother, where's your father, et cetera. And to the surprise of the people filling it out, we checked. And doing that, we got eight stories, eight undercover agents trying to either who had already been working around us or had gotten, you know, who were trying to work. And so and before we would tell them, we knew, we'd say, oh, you have to come in for a photograph. So we'd take their photograph and put it in the newspaper. And so we did a sort of national version of that for Ramparts. That was our first story. The second one was really a compilation of a series that we had done over a couple of years that really convinced me that this might be a business that I wanted to stay in. And it was really a profile of San Diego's man of the century. That is, he was man of the century in 1969. He was indicted by 1973, and in part due to some of the stories we did. He was convicted, by the way.
You also worked for Jan Wenner's Rolling Stone. Were you there at the very start of Rolling Stone?
No. The start of Rolling Stone, it was in the first couple of years of Rolling Stone, those of us who were in the alternative media looked at Rolling Stone at what we called hip capitalists. You know, they basically tried to suck up all the record ads, which was the one source of income, and say the rest of us were like, you know, wild-eyed, crazy people. But I, you know, eventually I went to work for him in, I think initially in 1974. I worked for him 74, 75 into 76 in San Francisco.
And what caused the parting of the ways?
He was moving the operation to New York, and in the inimitable style of Mr. Wenner, he fired me on Christmas Eve, 1976.
A real sentimentalist.
Yeah, well, he did. I think it's fair to say that he's fired just about everybody who's ever worked at the magazine, and then they would be hired back. But I wasn't about to move to New York.
What then drew you to programs like 2020 and 60 Minutes? Was it big budgets, big audience, getting your calls returned?
It was called being a single parent and needing money. And ABC News was expanding in late 77. They came out here and asked me if I wanted a job doing investigative reporting, possibly for something they hadn't named the program yet. For a magazine program because they wanted to compete with 60 Minutes. And my condition has always been I won't move. And they said okay. And so I started, I believe it was March 1st, 1978, working for ABC News from Berkeley, California.
Hmm. When you began on 60 Minutes in CBS, was there a consciousness in CBS of the legacy of Edward R. Murrow, the man who took on Joe McCarthy and who's depicted in the film Good Night and Good Luck, that
sure.
they needed to do to continue to do the work he was doing?
One of the producers, that is, you know, there at that time when I joined, I think there were four correspondents, or you called them presenters, right? They wouldn't like that in the United States. Because the whole structure of the way in which these programs are done is to present the correspondent as the reporter.
That's not actually the case, though, most of the time.
Most of the time, the vast majority of the research and reporting prior to shooting or even during shooting and fact-checking and so on is done by the producer and or a team, the producer, the associate producer, and so on. But the style is to create the correspondent. In Don Hewitt's words, to show the audience the adventures of Mike, Morley, Harry, et cetera. See, first of all, you have to understand that in terms of the legacy, Harry Reasoner had worked with Edward R. Murrow. In terms of the legacy, there was a gentleman who's depicted in the film.
Fred Friendly.
No. Fred by then had gone to Columbia. Mm. No, there was a producer named Joe Wershpa, who I believe is played by Robert Downey in the movie, Robert Downey Jr. And Joe was still working at 60 Minutes. He'd actually, it's not depicted in the movie, but in the movie, you know, it's his relationship to his wife, and that was something that was needed to be protected. In fact, Joe was later fired by the so-called heroic William Paley in the movie, because a mag was like an industry rag called Red Channels had identified him as a member of the Socialist Club at Brooklyn College in 1939 or 1938, but he was famously hired back a few years later after everything had died down around McCarthy. And as Hewitt used to joke, you know, he's in a class by himself. You can't fire him again. But Joe is a great guy. He was there, and he was sort of the living legacy there, and often spoke up and reminded people of, let's say, their ethical lapses.
Mm. But what were the disadvantages, the inherent disadvantages of working for a corporate giant like CBS in terms of the stories that perhaps you could and couldn't do?
Well, I had to learn some lessons. I just spent 22 years working in network television news. I assumed going in, given my background, given some of the stories that I'd done, and just watching what people do and don't do, you know, as a reader, as a consumer, that there are certain stories that you cannot do, for instance, for network television news. I remember an executive at ABC News, after I'd had a number of successes on certain stories, and they actually made me an executive for a short period of time at ABC, saying to me, okay, what do you want to do? Anything you want to do, I need, you know, really blockbuster stories. And I said, well, you know, nobody's done the owners of NFL football teams. What's in-depth profiles? Who are they? Where do they come from? And I got into a kind of, you know, riff about, you know, who they are, you know, because the National Football League in the United States, which is this hugely successful, even then, 30 years ago, hugely successful operation and growing then, was started by bookies to give people something to bet on in the latter part, as the Depression was starting. So a number of the people who are involved have unusual backgrounds, but you can't report that. And I had already had an experience in a story that for ABC News, where I was doing a story about fixing horse races, and you know, the way that at least then that they fixed horse races is that it's very hard to make a horse run faster, but you can make it run slower.
Very easy.
So there was a guy who we managed to get on camera who had made an art out of fixing horse races, and what he did was, he would, if there were eight horses in a race, he would bribe the jockeys on five of the horses. And then in the U.S., I don't know about in Ireland, you could vote, you could place one of these complex trifecta bets, but you just do every combination of that, and you're eventually going to win a huge amount of money because you know that five of the horses can't win.
Hmm. So only three of the horses are actually racing.
And, yeah, and this included, that was in the early days of videotape, so there was a videotape of one race where actually at the starting gate, one of the horses leaps up in the air because the jockey's holding on so tight. But in interviewing the jockeys, what they explained a number of things to me, especially I remember Angel Cordero, who's still riding, I understand, and basically he said the following. Jockeys are the lowest paid professional athletes in the world, which I didn't know. Jockeys break every bone in their body, and it's extremely dangerous as a profession, and they're low paid. And they can be banned if they associate with a convicted felon or anybody that a Thoroughbred Racing Association says is of ill repute. Well, that year happened to be the year of when Secretariat won the Triple Crown. What Mr. Cordero pointed out to me was that the owner of Secretariat was a convicted felon and that he had served time in prison for bribing Abe Fortas when he was a Supreme Court justice in the United States, the only time that had ever happened, back in 1969, I believe he was convicted, about 10 years before we did the story. I did get the story on ABC News, but at that time, Rune Arledge, who was the head of ABC News, was also the head of ABC Sports. So I figured I need moving footage. I need pictures of the, you know, of the Triple Crown, Kentucky Derby, et cetera. No way. No pictures, no footage, because ABC put the Kentucky Derby on the air. So that conflict was right there. Now that is just an example of you will rarely see a network television news organization in the United States initiate a story about a supplier or an advertiser. It happens, but the exception proves the rule.
What kind of resources did you have at your disposal in CBS and ABC? CBS more particularly in 60 Minutes.
Well, 60 Minutes had the advantage of being in the top 10 in a period of regulation in the U.S. Broadcasting industry. And still today, I think its budgets are basically unlimited. If it's a story, you need to go somewhere, you need to check something out, you need to hire a consultant, you need to, you know, budgets were not the problem.
So nobody's asking you questions if it's taking you a month, 2 months, 3 months.
They'll ask, you know. But if you build up, a number of years, I had a pretty good track record of what they're interested in is product. What are you going to do for me tomorrow, right? So if you can keep those stories coming, and I guess my specialty was to come up with original stories. There is a complaint on the print side, you know, and I've been on both sides, and I've gone back into print and so on, and that is that most television journalists simply put pictures into a print story and rip off the story. I guess my specialty or my passion was to do original stories. So I didn't get that complaint very often from anyone in print.
And how far would you be prepared to go to get a story? What sort of risks would you take? I mean, I'm thinking of your work, for example, in Lebanon in getting the Hezbollah leadership on camera.
Well, after you've been in the business a while, and if you're not totally crazy. I mean, I would say I'm a little bit odd in certain ways. And if you take into consideration, particularly when you're doing television, that there are there's more than one person involved in the story. You're going to have camera crews. You're going to have other people. You're going to have a correspondent potentially and so on. So it's really much more of a calculation that you make. Reporters who have been or producers or crews, at least from U.S. television, who have been killed or captured in some fashion, incarcerated. Either it happens by accident, it's just totally unavoidable given the situation, more or less, part of the business, or it's just simply because there was no preparation. That's what happened in Nicaragua in 1979 when Bill Stewart, who was an ABC News correspondent, and his translator were killed on camera by Somoza's National Guard. He didn't speak Spanish. He was, in a sense, vacation relief. It was a new translator, which made the military people suspicious. They knew him from some other place, from the airport. And so it was those kinds of circumstances that lead to those kinds of challenges. When dealing with the Hezbollah in 1992, there was a long negotiation. You know, one of the things I learned over time is that almost any organization, however remote, however, let's say, being hunted by the U.S., it's always can find some representative, some way to communicate with them from London, from sometimes somewhere in the United States. There'll be someone who's in touch with them. Osama bin Laden, you know, those famous interviews with CNN and ABC and so on, the representatives for arranging those interviews and some later activities that I did after the Nairobi bombings in 98 were in Washington and London. I mean, Osama bin Laden had basically a public relations representative in London at least until 99 after the Nairobi bombings.
How close is the film The Insider to the real-life events that it depicts, the battle of you and Jeffrey Wigand against big tobacco interests?
It's not a documentary. It's emotion. I say that it's emotionally, politically accurate. It has some, in my mind, as both someone who's made films and done lots of stories, a couple of great scenes that help explain what the whole situation is about. There's a little made-up lunchroom scene where they explain that this is not about, is tobacco bad for you? That this is an industry that spends, I don't remember the exact number, $300 to $600 million a year on lawyers, and this is something in the public interest. So in that compact scene, written by Eric Roth and directed by Michael Mann, the audience gets information and gets information about the way in which network television operates, news operates, that it couldn't get watching television or reading most newspapers. So from my perspective, the film tells stories that, and one of the reasons I got involved in it early on, tells stories that a mass audience in the United States couldn't see or hear, you know, especially on television. I should add what normally is not known is that when you work for network television in the United States, the boilerplate contract you sign says that they own everything, everything you do, and that you have a financial responsibility not to say anything negative about them. So in order to do that movie, I was released by CBS from my contract to do the movie. That has to do with all kinds of circumstances where they had suppressed the story for a while, and then all of a sudden they looked, they gotten through it, and it had been on the air. And also their assessment, as a associate general counsel said to me when they agreed to it, that, you know, 2,000 movies are optioned every year. This movie is not going to have any sex, death, or violence on it. You'll probably get a good fee. So we think you deserve some money. No one will ever do this.
Boy, were they wrong. How did you persuade Jeffrey Wigand, a scientist, a former director of a Fortune 500 company, and a man with a gag order around his neck, to go on the record?
It took 18 months. It required understanding his personal situation, having the resources of an organization like 60 Minutes to make the trips, to have my associate producer, Debbie DeLuca, work with him and make trips when I couldn't, to keep in touch with him. It was difficult, and it wasn't something that he did lightly.
Yeah, I mean, to what extent was his life falling apart because of his association with you?
Well, I you'd have to ask him. I would say that his decisions, that his wife was not in favor of him going public and, in a sense, committing suicide on television. Her father was a doctor in Louisville. He owned a tobacco farm. He was perceived by his in-laws as being a traitor, to the extent that he had actually had a falling out with the company. So even before there was any knowledge of what he was doing with me, you know. So but as to what was a catalyst or helped exacerbate his situation, you'd have to talk to him.
But do you find it hard to be instrumental in putting someone through what he, at least in the film, goes through, which would be partly down to his association with you?
Well, there's an obligation on my part. And the obligation is to try and protect my source, especially when the source, first of all, if he's a confidential source, not to reveal his identity. And then if he or she decides to come forward and tells the truth, try to help them deal with the consequences. We had two major problems here. And the first being we had a hugely litigious industry. Mm. So that was always hold over our head. We had the guy who at that time owned CBS, Larry Tisch, also owned a tobacco company. His son, which is not in the movie, does not explained in the movie, is one of the eight executives who holds up his hand before Congress and says, I believe that nicotine is not addictive. And we have a criminal grand jury seated that's investigating perjury before the United States Senate. And we have Wigand scheduled to be a witness before that grand jury at some point, as of about a month before we actually sat him down for the interview. So you've got all these conflicts going on at the same time. It's a very unusual situation. My position was from the beginning that as long as he told us the truth, and that's what we said to him in a letter, that we would help defend him. That was something which CBS didn't want to go through with.
Yeah. Because he was interviewed on camera by 60 Minutes correspondent Mike Wallace, but CBS decided not to air the interview. Why did the story fall foul of corporatism?
Well, there are two major reasons. ABC News had done a story a year and a half earlier about the alleged spiking of nicotine in cigarettes. Philip Morris, now called Altria, sued ABC News for $10 billion. In the course of that year and a half, ABC as a company went on the block, and Disney was going to buy it. There's this huge libel suit standing in the way because it's a potential liability. In approximately a week before we actually sat Wigand down for an interview, ABC settled the libel suit, ran a retraction on a story that its producers and reporters to this day say was true, paid $15 million to Disney, ran full-page ads apologizing, and had Diane Sawyer on camera reading a statement which the reporters say is untrue. This made apparently some impression on the general counsel at CBS because...
You can't blame them. It would.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, you know, but as one of the attorneys at CBS, who's a friend of mine, said, she had never shown such interest in a story before on her own. You know, sometimes they would bring her stories to say, well, this is what we've done or some, you know, and she'd say, fine, no problem, because there was supposed to be this wall between the news side and the business side. But this in this situation resulted in her coming to the news division, which, according to Don Hewitt, who had been at the company since 1948, is the first time that the general counsel of the corporation had ever stepped foot in the news division.
And then the second reason was because CBS itself was
on the block.
On the block, was up for sale.
Right. Well, that appears to be one of the reasons. There are all kinds of reasons that they would be concerned. The problem they
at the potential of a
damage lawsuit. And understand that without getting into the nitty gritty of the whole thing, I understood this from the beginning. I had the expectation that Wigand was going to testify in October of that year in the ABC libel suit. He had agreed to testify in their defense, so we could run the story in terms of legal consequences in the United States. If you run information which is part of a trial or a public judicial proceeding, it's privileged. And so my expectation was to run the story on the eve of trial. Okay, there wasn't going to be a trial anymore because the case got settled. Mm. So I had some serious concerns. I was actually in the middle of reporting out the story because many of the people and documents at that point that could have helped corroborate Jeffrey Wigand's information were in London. So I was on my way to London to do more reporting. We weren't ready to put this on the air when this hammer came down and said, we're not telling you not to do any more reporting, but you can't use that interview.
And would the interview – it did see the light of day eventually. Would the interview have ever seen the light of day had you not gone to the New York Times with the story of CBS's – let's call it a failure of resolve?
Well, you know, you never know. I wasn't concerned at that point about the story itself. I was concerned with the idea that as a reporter that I would go to see someone, work with them for a period of time to get them to tell information that was in the public interest. You have to understand that in the history of the United States, other than Wigand, the only other fiduciary officer, it's called, of a Fortune 500 company, at least that I know of, who's ever stepped out front and talked about what actually went on inside the boardroom or inside the halls of power was John DeLorean when he did it with General Motors and he was ostracized and so on. That's how I looked at Wigand. And you have to understand that from the day I met him, I was in touch with the legal department. I memoed everything. I told the management at 60 Minutes as well as CBS News what was going on because I could see that they would tell you today. I always kept saying there's going to be trouble about this. I mean, look, he's saying information that's going to is damaging to the tobacco industry and possibly to the son of the owner of the company. They were ready to drop him off the edge of the earth at that point. That's what bothered me.
And they told you to have nothing more to do with
him. That's right. They had one of the lawyers call me when I was meeting with him after they said there were some questions. And I said, well, I want to go talk to him, continue reporting and fact-checking. And one lawyer said, okay, fine, do that. He had to call me at Wigand's house and tell me to leave the house. So they had made up their mind already. And then eventually the president of the news division, when I asked him, I said, well, these are just lawyers. what does the company say? And he said to me, the corporation will not risk its assets on this story.
But it wasn't just the company. You're being asked to hang a source out to dry. And were you disappointed with producer Don Hewitt's attitude and Mike Wallace's attitude there, at least in the movie, lack of support for you?
I have to say, I wasn't surprised by Don Hewitt's attitude. This, as Al Pacino asked me when he first read the script, he said, this must have happened to you before. You don't just walk out the door or do this after you've been somewhere for, I don't know, at that point I'd been there for 12 years or something like that. I was disappointed in Mike. I understood why, but I was disappointed. But it was a very difficult situation because at that point I was still inside the company. And do you, at that point, walk out on the steps and denounce everybody? Well, it was a little difficult when I thought that through because, number one, Wiegand was still a confidential source. He'd never been outed in public. So what was I to do? This next question is, who are you talking about? And I'd have to say, well, I can't tell you, right? And also, I'm an individual, so my desire was to use once the president of the news division told me what he told me, my conclusion was I'm going to use the assets of the company to get this story out one way or another, at least get some protection for Wiegand.
Don Hewitt and Mike Wallace are both very angry about their depiction in the film. Do you think they were treated fairly by Michael Mann, the director, and by Eric Roth, the scriptwriter?
Mike's opinion of the movie appears to have changed over the years. I mean, he seems less upset. At least from the remarks he's made, and I've talked to him subsequently. Hewitt got off easy.
It's as simple as that. Hmm. There was more to be told.
I think, to quote Michael Mann, if they had shown Don Hewitt in the way that I described him and the way that he operates, no one would have believed it.
Because a lot of stuff was thrown at you by CBS around the time of the movie. You were accused, for example, of actually negotiating with Michael Mann to make the movie while the controversy was still ongoing.
They made that up.
And you were also accused of having, or at least Mike Wallace said, that you basically came to him and asked for your job back.
And he made that up.
The film was...
You know what? The last one bothered me because a year and a half after all this, well, when the controversy was going on, having known Mike as well as I did, I felt that maybe it was time to, because knowing a lot about him, maybe it was time to ask him to sit down and talk. So I called him, and he was extremely warm, said, yeah, anytime. Eventually we did meet, and I assumed that the meeting was, I already had a job at the New York Times, I was already working with Frontline, and which was a PBS program, and to read 2 months later that's why I came to his house was very disappointing.
The film was released by Disney. Disney owns ABC. Would ABC have a vested interest in discrediting CBS?
No, and in fact, now you can ask Don Hewitt this question. When the film came out, Don Hewitt claims, and he's been quoted in the press, that Michael Eisner, then head of Disney, called him and apologized for making the movie. And when it was up for Academy Awards, normally what happened that year, for instance, for Academy Awards, Denzel Washington and someone else were profiled on 60 Minutes, which is a big deal for the networks, this big publicity. But no one, Russell Crowe wasn't profiled. And it was obvious for whatever reasons, you know. And Disney never re-released the movie. That was the other interesting thing. Most Academy Award-winning films or nominated films are re-released. Mm-hmm. This film was never re-released.
How did you feel about watching Al Pacino play you in the film, especially as you are a much younger and a much more handsome man?
And he's Italian and he's shorter than I am and I think he yells a little bit more than I do. Well, that part of it is an out-of-body experience, and I leave that up to other people who know me to have their comments on. I thought Russell Crowe was brilliant.
When you see photographs of Jeffrey Wiegand, you realize how close he actually was physically to Jeffrey Wiegand.
And he got, one of the difficult, I know Jeffrey would not like to hear this at the time, he's become a very good public speaker, but at the time, he spoke very much like the way Russell Crowe speaks, which if anyone knows about sound editing, very difficult to edit, I remember, in the editing room. So he got the mannerisms, the speech, and the frustration.
And did you decide to leave CBS totally as a result of the Wigand experience, or were there other factors involved?
Actually, I'm going to write about this finally. I mean, I've been threatening to do it for a decade.
I was wondering about that. You haven't really, I mean...
I've written a little, couple of little things here and there, but I've finally decided that it's, you know, there's a whole bunch of different things to write about. I had a contract with CBS, and that got modified, as I explained a little earlier, with related to the film. But I was still obligated to them, and so but I decided I was not going to work for 60 Minutes anymore, and that was agreed in the contract. And so I did a story that never aired for the Evening News, and that was the last straw.
So you decided to leave.
Well, my contract's running out, and I'm not exactly happy about staying in. But at that point, anyway, I had made other arrangements.
One of those arrangements, presumably, was Frontline, working for Frontline for PBS, for public broadcasting. While working for Frontline, you came to Ireland for a story, but the story had very little of anything to do with Ireland. Tell us about your pursuit of the former president of Mexico, Carlos Salinas.
Well, one of the deals that I, in my period of, let's say, separating from CBS, was that I became a freelance contractor for the remainder of my contract, which allowed me to work for PBS and Frontline, and a subject that you don't normally see done in depth in network television in the U.S. was, in this case, the growing scandal in Mexico over the regime of Carlos Salinas, his fleeing the country, his brother went to prison, and we called the film Murder Money in Mexico. So I came to Ireland in pursuit of Carlos Salinas, and he did meet with me, but he wouldn't be interviewed on camera. So you can, in the film, you can see me with him, you know, walking by the canals in Dublin and so on. And apparently he was there because there was no extradition treaty at that point with
It wasn't because he was sick of sunny weather. Or anything
I think he liked the tax situation as well as the extradition situation. And he was an equestrian, you know.
There are many more media outlets now than when you started your career. But is this, do you think, actually conducive to the spread of real information? Or will conservatives just get what they want on Fox News and liberals get what they want on NPR?
I think NPR would object to being called liberal. But that, that said...
Well, in comparison to Fox News, it's liberal.
Well, but there's an interesting idea. You see, in the United States, there was this development of what we like to call the professional journalism strain or strand, which got... a lot of impetus after Watergate. Newspapers in the United States, somewhat similar to those in Ireland and in the United Kingdom, would have different strong political orientations, Hearst newspapers, Scripps newspapers, and so on. The development of what of the U.S. news media as the dominant news media in the world for quite a while, that's changing now, happened over the last 35 years, more or less during the period of my career. And I would say that what's in danger now is that tradition, the tradition of in-depth reporting that reports without fear or favor, that doesn't have a political bias, or at least an outward political bias. What's in danger is covering the world in a kind of in-depth way. Maybe the pathfinder in that was the BBC to a certain extent. But even the BBC now, I know from a television point of view, doesn't do very much in the way of in-depth documentaries, for instance. And British newspapers are, you know, they have an outward political slant to them. So it's very possible that the U.S. news organizations will be moving in that direction, more of toward a niche market of already convinced people, rather than having a, if you will, a kind of objective central source of news. And that's, in some ways, you can see that in economics. Time magazine, Newsweek, they're in trouble in terms of circulation. Major metropolitan newspapers that dominate the market and are sort of an arbiter of the community are in trouble. So that's what's happening in the news business in the United States. The internet provides, obviously, all of these freebies, free distribution, easy composition of your material, infinite news hole. What it doesn't provide is the kind of experience that leads to reliability. And whether you're Google, who's dependent on repurposing this kind of material, or bloggers, you got to be worried. And in the interviews I've done with them, they are worried because that's where the information comes from. And what do you trust? I feel very privileged that I've survived, make a pretty good living, have a family together, and looks like I have some future.